Captain Wright, reel 5. I think now we come on to the crossing of the Volturno. What do you remember of that operation, the training for it, and then the orders, and then the actual thing?
The beginning of the Volturno, we were very short of officers and men, and the captain of my company was a man named Poxon. That I had right the beginning of the Volturno, the lead up to the crossing. We were short on officers and men, and my company commander was a man named Poxon. I'd never seen him before, not before that day. He was a little man, brown as a berry. Whether or not he'd been one of those imported from the east because we were so short. And there was one other lieutenant whose name I've forgotten. Anyway, I was called the day before we went over to take my men, 6 of them, and a chappie from the REs with 6 men and a boat, and they were to look for a crossing over the Volturno. Well, we got to the bank, and this chappie said to me, "Can you swim?" I said, "No, I can't." And anyway, they pushed the boat out. The river was in spate, you see. And as soon as he got it out, straight down. It took ages to fetch it back. And he eventually thought, well, the only thing to do is I must swim across with a line. And he stripped out to the buff with this line and got to the bank the other side. And I could see him now in the moonlight. It was like a big white slug on the opposite bank. And his men had loosed the rope. They obviously didn't want to go across either. Anyway, he swam back, and this boat was an awful job manoeuvring. We were out all night, and it was like a horde of elephants. Well, of course they knew. Our battalion was only a diversionary tack against the main one going off higher up. We were almost at the mouth of the river, you see, and the main attack went across higher up. And anyway, when I got back to the battalion, they were just moving out for the crossing. And they were last across, you see, and they crossed much farther up. And I had nothing to eat the night before, and I had nothing to eat at breakfast because I was too late, you see. And on the way up, I remember passing a chappie who was lying there dead. He'd had a bad wound in the throat, and it was festooned black with flies. I'd never forget it. And anyway, he got a bit further on, and there was Ted Greenwood, who was a sergeant in the MT. He was in the A echelon that moved up to the front as far as possible. And I looked across him, and he got a mug of tea. And he said, "I'll never forget your eyes." He said, "You got the eyes of a hungry dog." And I had. He said, "Would you like to remain to this tea, sir?" Rather. And he got a ham sandwich laughing. Mr. Stikers said, "Well," and I had that because I was absolutely ravished. And anyway, we got up to the crossing, and because I think our company was a bit short of men and everybody else, we were the last over, and we got over and took up positions in various slip trenches and whatnot. And this man Poxon came to me and said, "There's a sergeant and sergeant come down from A Company, that was Dennis Crewe's company, which was further ahead, and you see, we'd gone over without without support against tanks or anything, no gunners, and he said, they want you to take this sergeant and FOO order back to Dennis Crewe's. That was a signal officer, gunnery officer.
Forward observation officer.
Yes, forward observation officer. And so we set off, and before I'd gone Jack Robinson, these two men had disappeared. Well, whoever had said to take a platoon down to cover these men must have been stark raving mad. I mean, the sergeant had come from A Company without being seen, and obviously he knew the way and could get back and took this FOO. Well, I had no option but to carry on down, and my senior non-com was a corporal, Corporal MacDonald, who the last time I saw him was a cook. And I said, you come to the front with me, and we'll sort of do a bit of a leapfrog. And we got so far, and he opened up. Heavy machine gun it was. Well, of course, we got down to ground straight away. And I shouted up the 2-inch mortar. As I told you before, I knew my ropes on a mortar. And there was no answer. I said, bring the bloody mortar up. Still nothing doing. And I got up to see where they were. I stood up. And as I stood up, I had one straight through there.
Just below the left knee.
If I'd been kneeling down, that'd have been my luck, gone straight through the heart. But I looked round, there wasn't a soul there. They'd all disappeared. All disappeared. Anyway.
So your whole platoon had gone. Your whole platoon had.
The whole platoon gone. That was the first time. No, the second time. First time was up the hill with Sullivan. And eventually, MacDonald, who was carrying some smoke grenades, one hit him out of the smoke grenade with a cloud of smoke, and I could see there was nothing doing, and I said, right, we two are no good, back. And we got back.
How was your leg? How bad was it? How was your leg? How bad was it?
Well, if ever you tried to walk with your foot gone to sleep, that's how it was, you see, because it hadn't completely severed the popliteal nerve, but it was just hanging on the thread. And if that bit of MacDonald had given me help there, I couldn't have got back, you see. And anyway, we got back to our position. Of course, we'd been out some time, and there lay Foxham, the captain, dead on the in the dugout, and there's a small pack lay open, and in this small pack was four or five miniature revolvers, old-fashioned ones that he'd obviously looted from somewhere, and a little bit further on was a chappy named Dewsnap. I shall never forget his name. How on earth he got passed for military service, I don't know, but he was almost a hunchback. Dewsnap his name was. Anyway, eventually we got to the RAP, a regimental aid post, and the doctor McCrerigan. He said, "How are you?" I said, "Well, I'm at a job to walk." He said, "Well, let's have a look." So he bandaged me up, and he said, "You think you could make it across in the boat with these other walking and wounded?" I said, "Yes, with some help." See, got a job to stand up. Anyway, we got across, and I said, "Where's the Where the hospital is, it was straight down that road and to the right. Well, I looked down the road and the road was being hammered pretty well with mortars. They were mortaring ambulances. So I said, the lads right on the left, we go down, went alongside in the field. And eventually we got to this hospital, by which time I was a bit shattered, you know, then. And I can remember stuttering when they asked me what my rank was, the number and so forth. And they gave me a shot, and I can remember trying to fight off this shot, whatever it was, I wanted to know where I was going, you see, but obviously I passed out eventually, and I woke up in hospital. It was the I've forgotten what you call it. It was the hospital that was nearest to the line, and there, alongside in the bed, opposite me, was the colonel. On the right was the second in command, Goofy. Another fellow on my right I didn't know, and another fellow on my left I didn't know him. He was nearly up in bed because he'd been shot in the backside. And the orderly came round, a jug of water and a handful of sulfanilamide tablets, so they'd get those into you. And about half an hour afterwards, they brought us a meal. And that was all we had that day. And the next day, the colonel of the hospital came round and apologised. He said, "I'm sorry, but," he said, "we were not geared up to take casualties for another 3 days." He said, "you lot have been dumped on us, and you people who arms and legs and weren't too bad were left while we did the heads and stomachs and chests and all that sort of business." Anyway, he saw that we had another meal, and we had a night's rest. And the next morning he came round, and he said, he examined us, and he said, "you're for evacuation, mate." The colonel said, "you're not sending any of my men away." Anyway, they took him down to the toilet. I went further on down the line, and eventually I finished up on a hospital ship, I can remember there was a chappy in a bed further over, and he was waving. He obviously heard my voice, you see, and I said, "who is it?" And he said, Wills, he said, and I think he was one of the Freedom and Harvey Willis, and he'd been shot through the mouth, and we both finished up in Malta. It was a toss-up whether I went to Malta or whether I came back to England to Oxford for the nerve centre. Fortunately, I went to Malta; otherwise, I should have been Oxford, 30 miles from home, but in the second front. Anyway, there at Malta, we had the time of our lives, really. I was in this ward, hospital ward, and the sister was a little Scotch girl. She wasn't much over 5 foot, Sister Coots, I remember her name. And there were chappies there lying in bed, you know, some in case, the ladies and all that sort of business. And they had a big box sort of affair with a black rod that they pushed in and out. Well, they pushed it in, it jerked my foot up like that, you see, it was trying to get the nerve back together again. And of course, those that were mobile by the war, they had great fun operating this. But anyway, eventually we got round. I got round, this was October the 9th, this was.
That was the Volturno crossing. That was the Volturno crossing. So how long were you in this hospital?
Pardon?
How long were you in the hospital?
Oh,
at Malta?
I was just coming to that. They came round. Colonel came round and said, you're for evacuation, right? Well, prior to that, Sister Coots, it was just before Christmas, you see, about 10 days before Christmas, and Sister Coots had asked for a volunteer for decorations, you see. Well, my sisters, we've been dev hands at decorations when we were youngsters, and so I volunteered, you see. And she said to the colonel, "You can't do that, sir. He's in charge of the decorations." So he said, "Oh, I forget it then." So that was that. And I remember we sent out a patrol and pinched branches off bay trees. And I got those who could do something, sitting up in bed, cutting and making points on them, dropping bits of red sealing wax on them. And we made streamers from various things, and all the cotton wool all around the windows. And somebody said, all that's missing now is a Christmas tree. I said, good idea. So we sent a couple out on patrol to pick up a bay tree, the biggest bay tree they could find.
Right.
Yes. So they came back with this bay tree, which we decorated with various things, the cotton wool for snow and water, and two or three snails, a bit of sealing, one big blob of sealing wax on one, and two on another, and three on another, and eventually.
So, what was the point of that? Could you explain? They crawled up the tree as lights.
Oh yes, well the warmth, you see, we had the drink and the celebration, and obviously none of us at that time had any quantity of drink, and the people in the bed were rolling about in double quick time, and there was a Sister Coots and Sister Brown. Sister Brown, she had a husband in the services, and Cookerton said, "We can't leave this mess for the girls in the morning." He picked up a glass, and he got whiskey in it or something, just threw it in the fire, and it went whoosh. And before we knew where we were, the fire had all gone along the windows, and the people who couldn't get in bed were panicking. Anyway, we got topside of that, and the next morning they came up to photograph what was left of it, you know. But they're absolutely marvellous to us at Malta, and particularly the nurses. And as we were getting better, we were allowed out, you see.
Whereabouts in Malta were you?
The place called Antofia. That was overlooking the aerodrome. And we were the Valletta slide, you see, and there was a sort of boat affair that took you over to Sleema, where all the fun was, you see. They used to let us out, and we used to catch this. We used to catch this ferry sort of type of thing, go to Sleema. And Sleema in those days, two main streets, the main street rather, on the right-hand side, every other shop was a bar. You had a Rum Collins or a Gin Collins. And at the top there was a dance hall. We enjoyed ourselves there. And we missed the ferry back one night, but on the opposite corner there was an old retired seaman. He ran a doss house, where for a very small amount, I got what it was now, he had a bed for the night and a cup of tea, and he waited you the time you wanted to catch the ferry over. And that was still in operation many years after the war, and somebody had pinched his clock, and there was hell to pay, but they eventually got it back for him. And anyway, if we were late or missed that, and there was an inspection, the colonel come back, "Oh, where's so and so? Oh, he's got tummy trouble today, so he's in the toilet." And they made excuses for us all over the time. They were marvellous. There was one family there. His name was Count Testata Ferrata. So you can imagine what he was called. Rusty balls straight away. And he had a very nice looking daughter and a son who I think was in the submarines, which were based further over the island way. And we used to get invited to tea there, and they were very, very good to us. And the daughter's a lovely looking girl, but she was never on her own. There was always what do we call it, sitting in black, you know, who would take you from Ireland. As I say, they're extremely good to us. And those of us were very sorry to leave Malta. But anyway, I left Malta.
How was your leg? How was your leg at this stage?
Oh, look, perfectly all right then. See, the nerve hadn't been completely severed, otherwise I expect that would have been an Oxford job, but let's say I could have been out of hospital a fortnight before that. Only Sister Coote said you can't do that, and he didn't. And they used to hold dances, and we used to go to this dance. And it was a bit of fun dodging the matron, you see, because we were supposed not to be there. And anyway. I made my way back, to Italy, and I got to Naples.
Now, when would this be? January.
Pardon?
When would this be? January 1944.
Oh, yes, January. And there in Naples, of course, I very soon found the Orange Club, which was the officers' club, you see.
What was it like?
Oh, it was very, very good. Yes, very good. And
what did it offer for you? I mean, what did it offer for an officer? What did it offer for an officer? What could you get there?
Oh, you could get snack and decent drink and that sort of business, and talk to fellow officers. And while I was there, I met a chappie. And he said, "If ever you get the opportunity," he said, "get into the FSS. That was Field Security Service. He said, "I'm having a bomb," he said, "I'm making a bomb." And at that time, they were short of food further on from Naples, and it was being taken up to them in lorries, and eventually they had to send a company of infantry to protect it because it had been hijacked on the way up, you see. And anyway, I was there just over a week, I should think. And then eventually I got back to Italy. And the battalion, of course, were much further north, and I met up with Ollie there, Reg Oliver. We were both out of hospital, you see, and I can remember there was a crowd at the mountainous country, and there were these golden eagles soaring about, absolutely marvellous it was. And amongst all the officers, only one had got a pair of field glasses, and they were German. And they were passing the field glasses round for everybody look at these egos, you see. And what was the other thing? Other thing I remember. At night. So as I said, we were up in the mountains there, and there were these sparkles of light and so forth. They didn't know what they were, but they were fireflies. Never seen any before. Anyway, from there, we what did we do from there? Oh, we went on. We went on, and we got back to the battalion, Ollie and myself, and we found out that an officer had been made up to a company commander who had never seen action, and he'd just come out of England, which upset Ollie and I. Just after that...
Who was that? Do you remember his name?
Pardon?
Do you remember the officer's name?
Yes, I won't tell you.
Okay.
Say somebody reads it. But just after that, there was, on battalion orders, volunteers wanted for the SSS. On battalion orders, that was. So I said, Ollie, come on, let's have a bash at this. So we put our in our application for the SSS.
SSS?
Yes, Field Security Service.
FSS, yes.
Yes, FSS. Field Security Service. Now, anyway, we went before the colonel, and of course, Ollie was quite a bit younger than me. Ollie went in first, and the colonel said, "What's this?" He said, "The application of the SSS, sir." He said, "Not considered." And that was the end of his interview, you see. So I went in, same thing. "What's this, right?" I said, "Application for the SSS, sir." He said, "Not considered." He said, "With effect from tomorrow morning, you'll take over the duties of MTO. I said, "What?" That was marvellous. That was a plum job, you see.
Why? What was so good about it?
Pardon?
What was so good about it, MTO?
Well, you didn't spend all your life up the line being shot at left, right, and centre. And what had happened was a company commander, I think it's Williamson, his name was. He was a regular, quite honourable. He was a sergeant major at the time, and he served his time, and he opted out. That left a vacancy, and they made the vacancy for Dick Newell, who was MTO. Well, I say there were three of them together. There was Dick Newell. The adjutant Eric Armitage, and the other fellow, Keith, whose office had the fellow who worked with him alongside the bank. Anyway,
yeah.
I took over the MTO, you see.
Now, what was the job of MTO? Could you explain what exactly you had to do? What exactly was the job of MTO? What did you have to do?
Well, you were in charge of transport, you see.
And what did that entail?
Well, the organisation of all the battalion transport, when you think the number that was, 8-inch infantry company had a three-tonner, 1,500 weights, and probably a pickup, and then there was all the side things like in the M2, you had the petrol lorry spares and lorry for the sergeant, and altogether, there was quite a number.